The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever effervescent co-host, a man with an extremely high index of distraction, Bill Hunt. It took me all week to think of that one.
Man, well, I'm glad you did.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got the idea from, what was it, 2 weeks ago we decided that your role here on the show is as the off-color man.
Yeah, not the color guy, but the
off-color guy.
Yeah. I think that well.
I think that is appropriate.
Been doing it all my life.
All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, the title of today's program is Speech Synthesis from Darth Vader to Princess Leia. And our guest is Thomas P. Barnwell III, Emeritus Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering here at Georgia Tech. And Bill, why don't you give us the bio stuff?
Yeah, so Professor Barnwell got his BS a number of years ago from MIT and his MS and PhD. PhD in 1970, and then he came to Georgia Tech when Georgia Tech was a technical outpost. It was not really a research university. In his area of research, he's one of the original founders of the area of speech synthesis. So if you've ever been delighted by one of these things where you call in and push one for credit card information, pushed. You know, he did that. He's
making the universal sign for don't blame me for that crap.
Yeah. You know, and so it's, what we're going to talk to him about today is sort of this this very interesting career in an area called digital signal processing. So a lot of these algorithms and things that were developed wouldn't have been possible without being able to digitize speech, and then you have to break down what's going on with speech in order to produce it. He's an emeritus professor. He's also a musician, and he and his wife are in the Georgia Country Music Hall of Fame, got inducted a couple of years ago. I didn't know he played music until, this is quite a few years ago, I went with a buddy of mine up to a place called the Freight Room in Decatur. We were just going to sit there, and I'm sitting in the front row and look up, and there's Professor Barnwell playing harmonica and just jamming out.
Oh, they didn't call me Professor Barnwell.
What'd they call you?
Tom.
Okay. All right.
You didn't have like a cool blues nickname, like One-Eyed Willie, something like that?
Well, that's, yeah, he does have that nickname. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. One-Legged Willie.
And that's it, so,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that would work, you know, for, you know, publications in peer-reviewed journals as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, PA, you know.
Only the initials, yeah.
Yeah, One-Eyed Willie, PhD, yeah.
All right. All right. But before we get to the amazing world of digital signal processing, we'll begin the program with one of our favorite segments.
Science in the News.
And today's Science in the News article comes from the Science Times section of the New York Times, actually back from April 6th, but I brought it up today because I was going through old chemical and engineering news.
And the volcanic ash caused a time warp.
There it is. I'm going to stick with that theory. It's entitled, Scientists Discover Heavy New Element by James Glanz. A team of Russian and American scientists have discovered a new element that has long stood as the missing link among the heaviest bits of atomic matter ever produced. The element, still nameless, appears to point the way toward a brew of still more massive elements with chemical properties no one can predict. The team produced six atoms of the element by smashing together isotopes of calcium and a radioactive element known as berkelium in a particle accelerator about 75 miles north of Moscow on the Volga River, according to a paper that has been accepted for publication in the Journal of Physical Review Letters.
Are they taking suggested names?
Well, actually,
so is this going to be like the heaviest one found yet?
No, it isn't. So this is 117. So okay. 117 protons. We've discovered 116. We actually, back in March, discovered 118.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what they're all looking looking for mm-hmm. is what Glenn T. Seaborg called this island of stability. Mm-hmm. That if we get heavier and heavier and heavier, but have just the right amount of neutrons, mm-hmm. according to this theory, right. we might actually get something that will hang around for more than a microsecond.
Because most of them are not very stable.
Correct? Oh, right. They hang around for yeah. fractions of a second. They're completely gone. Yeah. And I believe it was...
So this is a heavy element with endurance. I would recommend...
Well, this one isn't.
I would recommend Oprah Winfrey-um.
Oh, that's good. But Yuri Oganessian, a nuclear physicist at the Joint Institute for Nuclear Research in Dubna, Russia, where this happened.
Dubna, Russia?
Dubna. Is it Dubna?
I don't know. I just think that's a cool name. I'd okay. love to live in I'm from Dubna, next to W.
Dubnium. Yeah, that's yeah. what we should call it.
Right.
He was the lead author on the paper. He points out this takes years to do because some of the work was done at Lawrence Livermore Lab, Oak Ridge National Lab, Vanderbilt, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Apparently, they determined the line on whether or not they were going to do this thing.
They just did the betting. Yeah,
right.
They just
as, did the betting. As well as the, another Institute of Atomic Reactors in Dimitrovgrad, Russia. So it's tough to figure out exactly what that name is. The point is, though, so far the pattern they see in the energetic stability as a function of how many protons are there suggests still mm-hmm. that maybe we're going to get to something relatively heavy one of these days that mm-hmm. will actually sit around. And supposedly in, I think it was 2008, there is a team of Russians that claim they actually... Amnon Maronov and six other researchers claim they found the element 122 existing naturally in purified natural thorium. And what this I guess brings to mind is if you had an element that could sit around for more than a few seconds, so you could do some chemistry on it, mm-hmm. you could do amazing new things. And the way normal people see this is they look at movies like I'm going to date myself here. I believe it's from the 1950s, The Forbidden Planet.
Okay.
With Leslie Nielsen, where they had this
really?
Society of Krell, and they had this Krell metal, and this made all things possible.
Mm-hmm.
But a more recent one's one of our favorite films, mm-hmm. Stargate.
Mm-hmm.
Stargate has this metal that, you know...
is only mined on
yeah, that does, yeah,
the
it does
universe,
amazing so. Things, and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, we've discovered all the stable metals... unless we mm-hmm. can find something way beyond 100 and what
right.
and it's probably not going to sit around mm-hmm. for years and years and you just use it.
Yeah.
But if it sits around for seconds or days, you might be able right. to do some interesting chemistry.
And one thing to point out that the way that these heavier elements get created is in a dying sun. So it's basically iron and everything else is produced
right, gets squished together. That's how we make
you know,
them. We squished up.
So again. We're all stars.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would apply that to you, Bill.
Okay.
He's doing the grandiose stuff. All right, so now back to voice synthesis and digital signal processing.
Mm-hmm.
What do we want to start with, Bill?
Well, I mean, why don't we begin at the beginning? So tell us how you got interested in this topic. What was there, had they just invented the A to D converter? What preceded this?
Well, I went to school at MIT in the 60s. I arrived in 61 and left in 70. And at that point in time, computers were just beginning to come into existence and be in heavy use, and or not even heavy use. In fact, the facility in which I worked is now kind of a living legend. The book called Hackers, it was about putting those computers together, and so it was a PDP-1, the first deck computer, and that facility had all kinds of firsts.
So the PDP-1, I'm trying to remember which movie. Oh, God, what's the one? Swordfish. So the guy's got his code stored in the basement of Caltech, and there's this PDP. It's on this old computer that's still on the net. So it's there were levers to push to boot up the machine, right?
The one I worked in was even older than that. It was called the TX0. It was the first transistorized computer ever,
and
had been built in 1956, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, to give you some perspective on this, I worked on it in the late '60s, and it's been in a museum since 1971. So.
Wow.
That can't be a good thing.
Yeah.
No,
and
no.
Tom's heading to a museum.
And I think you mentioned it was a deck machine. The Digital Equipment Corporation building was right down, is it Memorial Drive? What's the one that goes along the river? That disappeared when I was a graduate student years ago. I remember them just going out of business finally.
Well, this was the beginning and not the end. But that facility was the first timeshare computer ever.
Wow.
And oddly enough, it was mostly manned by the Model Railroad Club at MIT.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me?
So when your time was up, you heard a little...
I had this incredible room full of model railroads that just ran the time, clicking up and down.
Really?
And they automated that on that computer. And to do that, they built a time-sharing system.
So they switched model railroads with it.
Right.
Cool.
And it was the part of my system, a talking system, that basically translated the words into sounds.
Wow. Hmm. So let me ask you this very general question. Why would people think, I mean, it makes sense now in hindsight, right? My computer talks, it listens, it translates all sorts of stuff. But what was
it
the
first?
It
doesn't really listen, Pete. It just pretends to listen and goes, See, it's just look, like your wife.
Frankly,
it's pretending to listen.
That's a deep secret of speech recognition right there.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I think the computer listens more than my wife, frankly.
I'll get that on that right away.
So what motivated people to say, let's make a machine that can talk? Was it too much coffee one morning? Or?
Well, the
60s, remember, so let's not talk about what caused it.
It was called the MIT Reading Machine Project, and their vision was really sensory aids for the blind. The particular group at MIT, called the Cognitive Information Processing Group, was very much into creating aids for the handicapped.
Okay.
And so the vision of this was you walked into a library, you took a book, and you put it in this machine, and it read it to you out loud.
Right, and so half of that was this optical character recognition.
Right.
Your half was taking that information and getting it to read it back.
There's many steps in it. There was one whole project on the optical character recognition, there was a whole project on what was called grapheme to phoneme translation. And
then
once you have the words, how do you turn them into sounds?
Yeah.
And my advisor has more or less solved that problem at MIT in 1965. And when I came in on the scene, that was available. We had a machine that produced these sounds, and we needed to have it talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so for our master's thesis, I put together the first speech synthesis system at MIT. I teamed up with a guy named John McCool, who became quite famous himself, who built the hardware to do it. It was called a terminal analog synthesizer, basically a digitally controlled machine. And I wrote the program on this antique computer that controlled that in order to make it talk.
So how did you make it talk?
Very carefully.
Okay, good answer.
Yeah, the machine was an analog electronic model of a human vocal tract, which is really an acoustic filter.
Mm-hmm.
And what we hear when we hear different sounds is we hear the effect of different filters on acoustic filters being provided by the vocal tract itself, filtering the excitation from your vocal cord. So the different sounds are all different acoustic filters.
Okay, and when we talk about filters, we're talking about purely electronic, whether it's digital or analog. There were no vocal cords, there were no sonic cavities like your sinuses. Basically, you take in a whole bunch of frequencies that you can generate electronically and filter parts out to get the tones and the vowels.
Correct. What we're really talking about is resonances.
Mm-hmm.
The vocal tract has about four major resonances, and as you change the shape of your vocal tract with your tongue and your jaw, those resonances move around.
Right.
And that's what you hear is different sounds,
right.
Particularly different vowel sounds. And the goal of the machine was to build an algorithm which could create a pattern of those resonances that would be interpreted as speech.
So you're working in the world, so for our listeners out there, if you go into some science museum, you talk into a microphone that goes into an oscilloscope to give you those frequencies, you're working on that end of it, right?
That's correct.
Right.
Correct. Well, and I think, let me know if I misrepresent things, but the name of the show is Inside the Black Box, and engineers, electrical engineers.
The computer was yellow, by the way.
It was a yellow box.
Today only is inside the yellow box.
You're making this up.
No, I can't make up stuff.
He's a musician. He's artistic. Cut him some slack, will you?
The yellow box. Okay. Way back in the day, Ford got a paint job. It needed a paint job at some point. So it was the same color as the 57 Dodge, wingtip thing, yellow. Anyway, the black box. Electrical engineers talk about that. You know that. You don't necessarily have to know what's in the box. It's got resistors, capacitors, amplifiers, whatever, but you can characterize it mathematically so that you know that if you put an impulse or a click or spark into it, that it has a certain behavior coming out. And in addition, if you alter the input signal, you can alter the output signal in a known way. So basically, you are creating a black box for the vocal tracts for these different sound, correct?
That's correct. And in fact, it's one of those areas where linear system theory, the great tool of engineering, applies very well. And you can describe acoustic systems, you can describe electronic systems, you can describe mechanical systems, all with the same set of equations. Mm-hmm. And that is, in fact, where the theory came from. And that was, in fact, why we could build an electronic version of something which was basically acoustic to start with.
Okay, when you say linear system theory, mm-hmm. you're right. Scientists and engineers like to use that in lots of different fields, mm-hmm. mine as well. But we're talking about, what, a set of coupled linear differential equations? Is that what you mean when you say that?
That is one. But in fact, it's one of the world's simplest definitions and one of the most powerful and rich areas of mathematics that has ever been discovered. Uh-huh. Perhaps the most powerful.
Right.
And at least in engineering sense, in terms of building things and mm-hmm. understanding
right.
things.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was digital allowed. So if you think about this filter, you can just digitally very rapidly change the characteristics of that filter. It's like you went into the black box, change this inductor, that capacitor, and then you get something out. So if you had to build it from components, you couldn't rapidly change it.
Right.
Like
the original synthesizer was a hybrid. It were analog mm-hmm. filters with digital controls.
Voice mm-hmm. synthesizers?
Yeah, the one that I had was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and perhaps for our listeners, we want to go over the difference between analog and digital really quickly, because I think that's confusing. So what's the difference between analog and digital?
Well, digital really is things which are represented by numbers.
Right. Right.
Basically, things that are in computers, stored in memories, all of those mm-hmm. kind of things. Anything that falls in that class is digital, right? Analog are things which are represented not by discrete individual things like numbers, but by continuous things like
right.
waveforms.
Right.
Right. And the device that connects them is often called an analog to digital converter or a
right.
digital to analog converter.
Right.
And at the time we were working on this, all of the control algorithms were digital. The controls for the synthesizer were digital, but the synthesizer itself was an analog device.
Right. And I think a lot of people take that for granted. I mean, when you think of these waveforms, these oscillating curves, they're more or less continuous. And then when we digitize them, as long as we sample them at a fast enough rate, mm-hmm. it's literally numbers that represent that oscillation. Everything people do with now in computers is all digital, but there were actually analog computers
right.
way back when.
Right.
You turned a dial, a potentiostat
right.
or something.
Right.
Yeah, and what digital signal processing really is a digital form of linear system theory.
Mm-hmm.
And the connection is what you just said, the theory called Shannon's theorem, that says if you know how much frequency there is in an analog signal, you know how fast you have to sample it to get all the information.
Mm-hmm. So you got to sample fast enough to capture that highest frequency.
That's correct.
Right.
If anyone would like to call and ask a question, 404-894-2468, or request that Professor Barnwell generate a new voice for Stephen Hawking because you're tired of the one that he's got, you know.
You know, you think the guy who holds the Newton chair could get a better synthesizer?
It's not the Newton chair.
Oh, what is it? What is the chair?
Lucasian chair.
Lucasian chair, which Newton held.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But did he do that for a fact? Did he narrate the whole, a brief history in time with the, yes, and now the universe explodes? Just to make us seem like he was a geek or cool?
Yeah.
Because so here's an interesting question. Now, with the miracle of digital signal processing, there are much better voices.
There are much better voices, yes.
Right, okay. And so So how did that happen? You made the first this talking machine at MIT, and it must have sounded worse or similar to...
Well, if you want to hear them, I brought a couple of examples of what the early stuff was. What I brought was actually a synthesizer that predated the one at MIT.
Okay.
It was kind of the state of the art. You may recognize it because it later had some popularity. But this came out of Bell Laboratories in 1961, and it's a song. They sing it. The reason they sing it is because they didn't know how to make the excitation part. But a song has a tone, and so they can use it to do that. They don't worry about that. And this is done by some people named Kelly and Lockbaum at Bell Laboratories, 1961.
I passed a whore to married, but you look sweet upon the feet of a bicycle built for two.
And that was not the latest hit out of Motown. So if you're calling the station at 404-894-2468 to complain that our music selections are getting stale, that was actually one of the first synthesized voices from Bell Labs.
From Bell Labs. Yeah. It took them about 6 months to do that. And for years and years, there was like three or four recordings that existed of that and a couple other things. And that's all there were that had ever been synthesized anywhere by a machine.
You know, that's what my avatar sounds like.
Yeah. Really?
I believe it. Sings, yeah.
I didn't have a copy, but I got it off the internet. You can get anything off the internet now. So.
Wow.
Okay, I have another example here of what it was like.
So let me follow up one thing. So
speech this is so familiar, a feature of daily life.
I'm stopping.
That we really paused. There we go.
So the interesting thing there, so the first success, if you will, was 1961, but the area didn't take off for a few years. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, it was really around 65 that people began to kind of seriously try to do this. There was a group in England called Holmes, Mattingly, and Sherm in the early, about 64 or so, that had did some initial work. And my master's thesis took a lot of their work and followed up on that, yeah.
So it was, that's a sort of story often told that somebody comes up with something that's really new, but it takes a little while for it to catch on and for people to take the next step. So anyway, but you can now play this next one.
So this is what it was like after I left. This is the MIT system running fully. It's just the reading machine, so it's running all the way through from my...
Speech is so familiar, a feature of daily life, that we rarely pause to define it. It seems as natural to man as walking, and only less so than breathing. Yet it needs but a moment's reflection to convince us that this naturalness of speech is but an illusory feeling.
So that would have been about 1971 or so, when they kicked me out of MIT. And the big advantage of that was, I wouldn't say that it was so much better quality speech at that time, but that it was the entire system. You could, in fact, work it all the way from a book through a system to produce.
Okay. So the throughput was good, right? It wasn't. So you mentioned what it took. How long did it take to produce that one Daisy song?
It took like 6 months.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But no, the system, is, I just pointed out that at MIT, was real time.
Right, so you could type in or read optical characters and boom, it would do it.
Right.
So I've got to say this. That is basically the same, that sounds like the exact same synthesizer that Stephen Hawking used in A Brief History of Time.
Yeah, the state of the art and signal and synthesizers remained about the same until around 2000. I worked in speech coding after I left MIT, so I didn't do any more work in synthesis. But but there was a breakthrough around 2000, and it's a kind of a larger hammer breakthrough. You know, the Moore's law, this amazing doubling of compute power every 18 months, is when you figure out what that means, it's truly scary.
Yeah.
But it means we have such power and such memory capacity that we can have approaches that made no sense years ago. And what they do now in speech synthesis, which sounds much more natural, is they do real-time mining of real speech. So you have huge databases of speech, real speech, and you do you take all the things that we knew in the 60s about what speech is supposed to be and trying to create them from whole cloth, you search for pieces that match that criteria and go together.
All right, so for our listeners out there, we're talking with Tom Barnwell about speech synthesis and the history thereof. If you've got a question or a comment or a complaint about some really nasty elevator or tram at an airport that you don't like the voice.
Or if you're Stephen Hawking and you want to call in.
Yeah, and complain about us picking on your speech synthesizer. Yeah. Give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So you mentioned before that...
So what was the breakthrough in 2000?
Yeah.
The breakthrough in 2000 is they quit trying to model the entire vocal track and system and modeled what they could and then use that model to match it against real speech, which they had in copious quantities.
Oh, okay. Great, so the search engine and stuff. So they
data mining.
So before that, the work was to try to get a better mathematical model for the vocal tracks, and they just sort of said, you know what, that's never going to get us there.
And your observation is correct. The ones that they had by the late 90s were better than what I showed from 71, but they weren't remarkably better.
Right. I can't tell the difference.
The early stuff just had a lot of holding power.
Right.
And so it was a problem that, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, it's the advantage of gigantic technological capacity over science, over theory, I guess.
Right.
And that you couldn't have imagined doing anything with real speech in 1971.
Right.
But because we now can put together these massive databases on small devices that are cheap, this is a viable approach, and it solves the problem.
But I will say this, that, you know, sometimes making it more realistic is overkill. If you think about the applications, I saw the movie Brief History in Time. I read the book Brief History in Time. Mm-hmm. It gives Hawking more credibility that he talks like a Cylon from Battlestar Galactica when he does it. So, I mean, if he walked in and they did a modern synthesizer of him as, you know, Peter Griffin from The Family Guy, and he was like, Stephen Hawking here, and my son Stewie and I will explain how black holes work. It's not going to cut it.
No, I don't think
so. And same thing when you're – so I think of the Atlanta airport, right, one of the busiest airports in the world. You have that tram, and back before the 96 Olympics, Darth Vader actually told you to get out of the way of the
really?
Doors. You want people
Did
to get
he?
Out of the way of the
you
doors.
You got out of the way. If
you
Darth
got out of the
Vader
way. And now it's like, ooh, Mrs. Doubtfire here. You get back from the doors, my little puppets. And you're not going to take that seriously.
No.
So I kind of like the old one, but I can see applications for something that's a little bit better. I guess the whole thing is, so when you say data mining, right? Data mining, we use data mining in just about everything.
Yes.
Basically, you take pre-recorded voices, and you don't just try to slap those together with scotch tape. You go in, do digital signal analysis, and try to get all these different frequencies that make up that complex texture. Is that what you're doing?
Well, you have a representation for the speech, and it can be the waveform or it can be an analyzed form of it. But what you do is you go through and you analyze it as best you can. You try to do a partial recognition, so you label phonemes, individual phoneme sounds. Mm-hmm. You recognize boundaries between phonemes. You remove the actual excitation and timing, which is what's one of the more difficult things to do, which is implicit in all of that. And so you have these waveforms, and you have all this description of the waveform, which is not totally complete but partial. And then you know what you want to say. You know, in a sense, what's out there. And you can go out there and find things that match what you want to say. Small pieces, sometimes entire words. That's lovely. Sometimes only individual sounds. If you can't find it, you can always go back to the basic techniques that we were talking about from the late 60s, in which you create it from whole cloth. And you, if you listen to that, you know, the larger the amount of speech you've got, the better it performs, because the more it has to mine from.
Okay.
And so a lot of times, if you have a very specific application area, like an automated airline reservation system or something, then you can populate that with speech about those things and get that to work.
So you take speech with words like, you know, reservation and seat choice and all that stuff, and I
am the manager. You know, when you ask them to speak to the manager, and they tell you, I am the manager, you know, stuff like that. You've had that experience, I'm sure.
Yeah, I have a dark secret. We had some of the first computers that talked ever.
Mm-hmm.
And we got them to talk to us. For example, when my computer quit in 1960, you know, program stopped mm-hmm. in 1967, I guess, it would say stop.
Okay.
It got irritating after about a week, and we turned it off.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, we were the first ones to make them stop talking, too.
Oh, there you go.
I thought the dark... Did you ever crank call anybody with the...
That would have been good.
Synthesized voice.
That sounds like a good, you know.
Well,
MIT
hack.
Is your refrigerator running? Well, you better go catch it. Stuff like that.
Well, the stuff that was at the airport wasn't really synthesis by rule. That never was text. What that mm-hmm. was actually a form of coded speech, mm-hmm. where they had replaced the real excitation with just a monotone.
Okay.
About to begin the rush.
So that it was basically programmed to make normal speech sound boring.
Yes, exactly.
I would think that would be popular at MIT, actually. Mm-hmm. Which, for our listeners, that is mutant in training, MIT, in case you're wondering.
Well, it just makes me wonder about, you know, you're talking about this is funnier than science. I can't think of anything much funnier than science.
Oh, okay. Well, we think science is funny. The rest of the world doesn't. That's why we're here.
To paraphrase Douglas Adams, you know, to see anything, find anything funnier than science, you're going to have to go into a research laboratory and look at a scientist.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If you can't be funny looking. That's our motto here on Inside the Black Box.
So next thing along here, the paradox of DSP, digital signal processing research in 1971. What is the paradox?
Well, when we made a speech synthesizer in the 60s, we built this huge machine. It took half a room to do it. And to make it talk, you had to, you know, that was a big expenditure of time, effort, all of those kinds of things.
Not to mention plying it with liquor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that wasn't what we plied with.
Moonshine, actually.
That's another story.
It's the country music bleed over these studs, moonshine.
But then it became obvious that you could use a computer to what we thought in those days as simulating analog systems.
Mm-hmm.
We now think of it as digital signal processing. In those days, I didn't have to build a synthesizer. I could simulate one. The problem was to do a single sentence, I had to do 4 hours of computation on a computer in the early 70s.
Oh, okay.
And that was the basic paradox. You could do all of these powerful, wonderful things, but the compute power it took to do them was so astronomical that no one could believe anyone with any sense would be doing it.
So what was your quote that you gave in my class on this that, I'm trying to remember, that...
Bill, stop using so much hair gel.
Ten times the expense for... Do you remember that?
Well, I talked about speech compression. In the early 70s, I joined some signal processor people here, Ron Schaefer, who really invented the field by naming a book that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of excitement about signal processing, and I was exciting digital signal processing, and I was excited too. But it was also there were a lot of things about it that were long-term visions, and so I was made fun of it a lot, and so I put this on my door just to irritate Ron Schaefer at the time. And I said, speech compression, the set of techniques which will allow us to replace two telephones with two $10,000 array processors and two $3,000 modems with only a moderate increase in distortion.
But that's how a lot of applied science starts out, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, it also speaks to the idea that, you know, you're working on something and the result isn't going to be dazzling right away. So you talk about all this expense, and you go, well, gee, why would anybody do that? If you're looking in 6 months to have this all work out and be cost effective, you wouldn't do it in the first place.
And is that fair to say that the reason we first do things, I think about the first vacuum tube computers, and you know, they could add stuff up. They could multiply numbers, you know, stuff like that. They did it because they wanted to see if they could. Then once you could, you hopefully take advantage of things like Moore's Law and things like that and other technology improves. And then suddenly, decades later, you've got something that's really applicable, really important.
Oh, that's right. And I think, you know, maybe in 1971 it was hard to see, but by 1976 it wasn't hard to see anymore.
Right.
The beginning of the integrated circuits revolution had started. Mm-hmm. I think Moore's Law dates from around that kind of period.
Right.
And it became obvious, you know, if it hadn't happened, we would have been idiots, considered to be idiots later on. But it seemed obvious at that time that a world was coming in which we had the compute power to do all of these things.
Right.
And that's, in fact, what happened.
Wow.
Now, is it safe to say that a lot of the work in the early days was developing algorithms that were computationally efficient? Since you had such slow computers, did you look at ways, how could I do this with fewer processing, as opposed to brute force, I'm going to, you know what I'm...
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
the
actually,
algorithms had to be efficient.
It had to be efficient even to be able to simulate it, because if it were too inefficient, we didn't write in high-level languages. We wrote in machine language because you needed that level of efficiency. And you thought about tricks inside the algorithms. If you look at a lot of the history of early digital signal processing research, it was on how to make algorithms more efficient, less multiplies and adds to do what you wanted to do. And so there was almost two camps. There was a group of people who thought purely in theoretical terms, and there was another group of people who took the theoretical results and thought about how you implemented them in a way that was efficient enough so it might be actually useful in some kind of application. And speech is arguably the lowest bandwidth, least frequency signal that is really of a lot of interest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you know, there are other ones, of course. Images have more, video has more, radar.
Right.
All of those
things. Music would have more than, say, speech.
Music.
On a level.
And
right.
But as the lowest one is the one that took the least computation in order to implement a lot of these techniques.
Right.
And so it became the hotbed of signal processing research because it was the application that you could reach first when you reached one.
Cool.
Hmm.
And I guess to compare and contrast the way we do things today, I mean, right now, I know our listeners are listening. And then again, if you've got a question about, you know, digital signal processing, which you won't, but you might have something about the application, give us a call here as we're talking with Tom Barnwell at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. Now, you know, because seeing as how you're the only technical expert that is a member of the Georgia, State of Georgia, what, Country Music Hall of Fame?
It's actually Atlanta Country Music Hall of Fame.
Oh, Atlanta Country Music Hall of Fame.
I've expanded it. I know that.
I appreciate
but
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, so I have programs on my computer that I write accompaniment parts because I play trumpet occasionally. Bill writes entire music pieces on it. The way musicians do things now, you've got a MIDI interface, you take that signal in, and we process this thing. Now, what took a lot of programming for you, I hit one button and suddenly this entire piece of score that I've written changes from a upright piano to an organ to a trumpet. I mean, they don't get the brass voices all that well, but the piano voice on my computer is absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, and that's digital signal process.
Yeah, there it is.
Well, and with the string quartets I've been composing over the last couple of months here, I enter it note by note. A MIDI file can be output from that program, and I run it through a MIDI to wave converter, and then in about 20 seconds it's converted it to about a 200 megabyte file that sounds pretty close to the actual instruments. And in 20 seconds it does that. What would that have taken back in the 60s or 70s?
Well, it would have taken days or weeks. And I'll give you a few numbers I know. In 1973, when I did the first vocoders at Georgia Tech, it would take 4 hours to do 1 3-second sentence.
Wow.
To do a simulation. And what computers we had...
Was that modeled on Roger Webb's speech pattern?
That would have taken longer than that.
A man of few words.
Okay. Well, so yeah. The former school chair, ladies and gentlemen, who is
anyway,
freaking out.
He spoke very slowly.
Well, he did. I've been in meetings with him.
And, you know, he would never, like, go on and on and on with the parrot. I mean, you would listen to what he said because he thought about it before he said it, but he didn't use a lot of words. Anyway, So 4 hours to do a three-word sentence.
Right. And we never turned those computers off. We built automated systems so that because we couldn't store the results either. We didn't have the memory. So the computer would do an analysis. It would play it back. It would turn on a recorder and record it, and it would start on the next one. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was cracking out experiments.
And you just got a tape recorder of recorded four-hour sentences took three seconds.
So we've got a caller on the line who's got a question. Yes, welcome to the program.
Yes, I had a question. I'm not sure if you guys have talked about this already, but how long before, voice will replace text messaging that we typically
Right, so like on your phone, how long will your phone just recite the text message back to you? That sort of stuff?
Exactly, right.
I mean, the technology's there now. Do you have a GPS?
Yeah.
Because the GPS is, they used to do a lot of this data mining stuff so you can get the really nice, sultry voices. But now what they'll do is they'll pronounce the street name. And
right.
Those are more, those have a big synthetic component to it. Mine has it. And I don't have a lot of money. I got a pretty cheap GPS.
And a cheap car, by the way. But to match. Soft topic.
But what they'll do is, you'll see it struggle with the pronunciation, right? And it pronounces a lot of Atlanta street
right.
names. Sometimes it gets upset that there are so many peach trees and tucks back.
Ponce de Leon.
But is it fair to say that that technology is here now?
Oh, yeah. It is true that to do it with a great deal of quality
mm-hmm.
probably takes more horsepower than you're carrying a cell phone right now,
right.
more memory. But the technology is there for that now. It just is too expensive for a cell phone. But there are certainly technologies that are not too expensive for a cell phone that will talk and is highly intelligible. Yeah.
I mean, the other issue there on the cell phones is talk time. So if you have that and if the text being read to you...
Does that count?
If it chews up so much power that you only got, an hour worth of talk time instead of... Yeah, so it's...
Or your battery.
The battery life and all that kind of stuff.
So here's the answer to your question.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, I had another question.
Sure.
What about speech recognition on the cell phone to replace text messaging? So in other words, if you wanted to send a text message to a friend and you speak it rather than having to text it in, is that around? Is that available? Does my question make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. The speech recognition has advanced a great deal, but it hasn't advanced as much as speech synthesis has. That can be done. Speech synthesis, I can say right now that even the inexpensive ones can produce intelligible speech, and the more expensive ones can produce very high quality speech and can do it very well. Speech recognition can do it only approximately well, and so there will be some errors and stuff involved in it. So it kind of depends on what you as a consumer are willing to accept for that kind of
right.
capability.
So potentially you could talk into your cell phone and then send Oprah Winfrey a text message while she's driving.
Again with the
That'd
Oprah
awesome.
Winfrey.
I don't know, I'm picking on her today.
Great question, though. Thanks a lot.
All thanks for calling
all
the show.
Right,
and I think with regard to the speech recognition, Trent's coming back in the room. He's coming back. Click us back. Okay. Did we lose our second caller too? Or?
Oh, he just wanted to say that you could do the speech to or text to speech on phones currently.
Oh, so he's actually got a phone that does it. Oh yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, I do too.
And it's you're just probably paying a little extra for the battery and the model.
Mm-hmm.
But the speech recognition thing, isn't that really an issue of noise to signal ratio and filtration, right? That humans are actually still pretty good at filtering out the noise. And the reason I know this, that computers aren't nearly as good, is because, so Trent's our computer guy. What's the name of the little technique, the Captiva, where you...
What?
You know, at the end of something, you put in a password, blah, 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 and for the computer...
Oh, the capture.
The computer to make sure that you're just not generating this automatically.
Well, actually, it's kind of funny. So they made the captures where you have to type in the text to get past it. And so then, but for the handicap, they had to make speech ones. So it would say something and you type in what it said.
Yeah.
But people actually figured out from algorithms that it's way easier to have an algorithm to hear what it says and type that than it is to figure out the text.
So what they need to do is do what real speech is like. Real speech has background noise and junk in it. They need to put the junk in it just like they put in the video capture one. Yeah. So.
Well, the problem you have is twofold. One is you don't know what kind of junk's going to be there because people try to do it everywhere. So the noise environment is... And the second thing is that the human voices are very different.
Mm-hmm.
And a speech recognition device which is designed to work for your voice is much more effective than one that's where you try to work for many, many voices. And, and so to such a system, other voices are noise too.
Okay, so
like when you have one of these annoying call, and I'm not blaming this on you, Tom, I'm really not, but you know they give you an option, yes or no. You know, they're not.
I always hit the one or the zero. I will not talk to these machines. Not, I won't do it.
They're not, you know, giving you, you know, give us. Why don't you recite the Gettysburg Address and then you know come back? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're asking you yes or no. So they've really then only got to decide if that was yes that you said or no.
Right, and that's easy. But when they ask you to put in your 10-digit airline number, nine times out of ten, it does not get it right for me. Mm-hmm. And I can only think what Katharine Hepburn could never use any modern, you know,
too much
voice
vibrato.
Recognition.
Yeah. To keep the record straight, I had nothing to do with voice playback systems on the telephone.
Sure, you didn't. Uh-huh. That's a non-denial from the Nixon Watergate era.
I will tell you here once and for all, in private, just among us, I did consult for the first elevator company to put speech in
Are
the
you
elevator.
Kidding? Really?
Okay. I'm afraid so.
Let's hope nobody storms the station.
Did you ever hear the Woody Allen routine on that? That he didn't get along with his electronic when he was doing stand-up.
Yeah, I did.
And so the elevator, he gets on.
Turned
after
on
he had turned up his, you know, torn up his toaster and says, are you the guy that tore up the toaster last week?
So, and all the, I mean,
and you did that.
He
to
did
Woody
that
Allen.
On the Tonight Show in the early 70s.
Yeah, I
remember seeing that.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, this is Tom's fault. I'm glad he admitted, you know, mea culpa to some of this, you know.
All right, let me ask a geeky question because it was in the program notes that we talked about before. And that is something that obviously fits into modern digital signal processing, and that's the wavelet, right?
Ah, the wavelet.
Yeah. So, first of all, and because so we use wavelets as basis sets, even in chemical engineering, you know, to sort of fit things. It's a very useful thing.
Hold on, basis set, a little bit. Okay. Needs a definition.
Set of functions that you use to reproduce something else. Set of functions that you might use in a model. But what is a wavelet?
A wavelet the mathematicians who defined it would disagree with me, but it's basically a digital filter.
Okay, and Trent's a mathematician. Is that a reasonable thing?
It's, yeah, I'm a tiny bit.
You can tell you're an electrical engineer because you everything's a filter for
you.
Well, that was low pass, high pass, band pass.
That was the name of his musical group back in the 80s, Tom Barnwell and the Wavelets.
And the Wavelets, yes.
Was it really? Or are you just making that
no,
up?
No,
I would believe that.
The story of that was that actually one of my students is quite famous in that area, a guy named Mark Smith, who's was actually professor here for a while.
And now he's at Purdue.
And I know Mark Smith, nice guy. Yeah. And he created something in his thesis called, which were ultimately called Smith-Barnwell filters.
Uh-huh.
And they were a set of techniques that allowed you to partition a signal into frequency bands without increasing the number of samples involved. So if you had 100 time samples, you could use these filters to give you 100 frequency samples, and you could recreate the signal exactly. You lost nothing.
And that
was a major kind of mathematical breakthrough. We were trying to use it to do speech coding, and it did, and it worked well, and we put it away. And then 5 years later, the mathematicians invented something called wavelets, which turned out to be the same thing.
Right. Right.
But they have great PR.
The mathematicians
Wavelet is such
too.
A cool name.
Much more so than Smith-Barnwell. No offense.
Yes, no, I know.
I believe Harry Croteau, Nobel laureate, pointed out that if you discover something cool, you also have to give it a cool name like Buckminster Fullerene.
He came up with Buckminster Fullerene as a name. He did the marketing for the research. So,
but to be, you know, look, we were engineers. We were interested in an application. We solved a fundamental problem to try to see how well it did, and we went on. What the mathematicians did was to come in and look at the broader picture, put a lot of formalism around it, and that opened up a lot of areas that we would never have thought of.
But I remember when wavelets first came out, as engineers, we said, wow, it's an interesting function. And the way I'm not an electrical engineer. I don't think of it as a filter. I think of it as, you know, something going up and down a wave. Mm-hmm. But you localize that. So that's localized in frequency, right? It only has one frequency if it's a single wave and maybe multiple if it's a mixture. But then you localize it in time. Right. You chop off the ends and make it sort of decay. So it looks like a little piece of a wave. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that function, I would guess, would be good for snapping out these little phonemes as you data mine these things.
Well, what's that really has more to do with the way the human ear works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The human ear, and this reason that the music, we love music, and the form of music is that way. The human ear really is a frequency resolving device. You hear different frequencies differently, and if in the naive way of electrical engineer, I can describe that as a filter bank, where in fact, and low frequencies are actually perceived at a different place in the ear than high frequencies are.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so the ear, with this wonderful mechanical system, breaks the signals coming in up into frequency bands. And, of course, it divides it in time as well, because we hear things changing as things go along.
Right, as time.
And so, in that sense, what a filter bank or a wavelet transform, if you want to call it that, if you insist on calling it by the incorrect form.
Okay. We'll do that for Trent. He's a discrete mathematician.
That's right. Does something very, very similar to what the ear does.
Ah, okay.
And so for people who are trying to code something and make it sound good, and we were trying to do it for speech in those days, but the big breakthrough here is audio coding. MP3s, MP4s all work exactly this way.
Cool.
It allows you to give it a signal where you can process it in a domain which is much more like what is going to actually be used to perceive it.
I used to deposit my paycheck in a filter bank. We have a caller on the line here.
Hello.
Welcome to the program.
Oh, yes. Oh, Dr. Hunt. Dr.
Yes.
Litovitz. Dr.
Hey.
Burnwell, thank you so much for taking my phone question. Just as sort of a follow-up to the fellow with the VOIP question. Probably the limiting factor on voice recognition is that there probably has to, at the other end of the satellite, be some secretary taking dictation or some robot that's finally accustomed to whoever it is, the arbiter of the voice. I was just wondering, like, when you think that the cloud computing is actually going to get all of its proper, like, currencies or, like, the electron magnetic dipole moments will be enough to transmit at such high frequencies that mobile phones can pick this up without it interfering with the FAA radar and aerospace.
All right, so we're going to have to apply a filter there, because you got about 7 questions in there. You started with cloud computing, which, by the way, is featured in this month's technology review from MIT. Cloud computing is really a network computing, right? Isn't it, Trent?
It's just a buzzword to me.
Okay. Yeah, Trent, always with the buzzword sorts of things. But it was featured as one of the top 10 technologies at MIT. Trent, always bashing the buzzwords. So wait, what exactly are we asking? Let's go for a more refined question. Will we ever get to something or other?
Yeah, I guess angular momentum for using the analog to electric sort of direct connect, like even for like eventual baselines using batteries that can be pure metal and not fully reliant on just gravitational orbitals to change like geostats for global positioning systems.
Yeah, I think if you're talking about quantum computing, I think we're probably quite a ways away from that. Thanks for the call.
Oh, what about the Star Wars initiative for like that sort of cloud? If there be some sort of like protect for like towers and how to, I guess, have non-interference.
So are we going back to the 70s with Reagan's X-ray lasers?
Well, yesterday was International Star Wars Day.
Oh, was it?
Industrial Light Management has changed to like Industrial Light Magic because they're like starting to work with some of this, I guess, in Los Alamos and stuff with their stealth.
So that's kind of funny. Here's what I did find out when I was researching this particular topic. What did I call it? From Darth Vader to Princess Leia. We called it that because some of the original ones, we heard that one that Stephen Hawking kind of sounded like Darth Vader. Now they sound much more pleasant voices. Mm-hmm. I looked up Leia, and because I had to spell this thing, and it turns out Princess Leia, single most popular thing, the metal bikini from Revenge of the Jedi. I thought that was a little
bizarre. I used to have
bizarre.
One of those.
And trust me, you don't want to see Bill.
Hung in the closet right next to my leisure suit. All right, thanks for the call.
Thanks for the comment. That was more questions than we can answer in an entire hour.
Yes.
All right, so, okay, so basically what we're saying is wavelets were cool before mathematicians got a hold of them and marketed them.
Well, they're still cool.
Okay.
And
it got created here at Georgia Tech.
Right, yeah. It was
by our good friend Mark Smith.
Yeah, and this guy right here.
All right. So we've reached the end of the program in that time we like to call What Have We Learned? All right, so let me take a crack at this.
We have to get him back on because we got less than a third of the list of things done here.
Well, we can do that. Really,
and I had another, there are all these questions, like one of my favorite movies is Bird, and they had the Charlie Parker. They extracted the saxophone from his old recordings and had him play with modern Simon because the recording technology was horrible.
Very scratchy. I have some of those old recordings.
But anyway, that'll be a future show. But go ahead. What have you learned?
Okay, so what I've learned is that whether we realize it or not, now, because of all this basis in technology that started as something that was really just kind of a toy, right? Because you take 4 hours to produce a 3-second sentence. Eventually, with computing power, as it is today, we sort of take it for granted that all musicians are really digital signal processors now. That's really what they're doing. And I think with regard to one of our calls, that phones will do text-to-talk when the marketers decide that they can make money off text-to-talk. But the technology is already here. That as difficult as it is to take digital signal processing and make it create the voice, it's even harder to filter out the background noise, the accent, the bar noise in Bill's case, for speech recognition. That mathematics is actually useful. So a concept of these little functions that look like a wave but are sort of, limited in time, wavelets, little bits of waves, were useful not only in digital signal processing, voice processing. They're useful. They're actually useful in video processing. Data compression in video does the same thing. And then finally, that we think Hawking, the Lucasian chair at Cambridge University, actually used one of the older ones just to sound geeky on A Brief History in Time. That's my theory, and I'm sticking
really?
To it.
Okay.
All right, what do we leave out? What else?
I think, one thing is, as we do on the program at times, look at people's careers. I think you've had a very exciting career, Tom. It's really kind of interesting to put that forth and look at the full context of a career, and we only covered part of what you got done. So,
well, I came to Georgia Tech at a very interesting time, and I couldn't have asked for a better career, really. I mean, signal processing came of age when I started, and it's a part of the technology when I finished. And Georgia Tech was becoming a research institution when I started, and now it's one of the major research institutions in the world. You couldn't ask for better than that.
And does it feel good to see that this area in which you work now has contributed to so much?
Yeah, my kids know how to use it too.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I mean, does it make the long hours and the low pay of a university professor worth it? That's what I want to know.
Well, but he did the consulting of the elevator company, so that he had that. Okay. He banked that. That in the filter bank. And
my actual best consulting project produced something called the talking hot box detector.
Okay.
Which actually has to do with a journal, a overheating journal on a train.
Oh, okay. So basically when it overheats, this mechanical element overheats, it will tell you, the brakes on, we're in big trouble.
Yeah, that's what the railroad calls that a hot box, and the system which was put in the late 70s, I guess, would radio the train engineer and tell him that he had
a
hot box.
All right.
Cool.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And for our listeners, please join us next week when the title of our program is It's a Bug's Life. Kostas Konstantinidis from the Georgia Tech School of Civil and Environmental Engineering will discuss the important role of microorganisms and the role they play in the global biogeochemical and life cycles, internal to humans even, on the planet.
Yeah.
So if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future program, by all means send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Or if you want to listen to one of our archive programs. You can find those on our website at insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology.
Shouldn't we tell them what they should do if they want to send us money?
I'm just kidding. Make it payable to cash. Send it to Bill Hunt.
In an unmarked envelope.
Care of the county lockup, Fulton County.
Okay. All right, never
mind. Please join us next week on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.